Hey everybody, real quick note before this episode. Yesterday we opened up a listener survey to get some feedback from you guys about how you listen to the show, things you like, you don't like, those kinds of things. If you've got a couple minutes, we would really appreciate it if you could give your thoughts about the show. The survey is completely anonymous, so you don't have to put any of your information. You can feel free to just be totally honest. And so if you go to skiffyfanny.com, it'll be in a post that'll go up before this episode. It'll also be linked in the episode notes for this one. It's also a pinned tweet on twitter.com/skiffyandfanty. So either of those are methods you can do to get there. So if you do take the survey, we really appreciate your time. So on that note, I hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show. I am Sean. I am joined today by four very special guests. I'm just going to go in order by the way in which you appear on my screen. So I'll start with you, Susan Jane Bigelow. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You want to tell everybody a little about yourself?
Sure. I'm primarily a science fiction author. You can find my work in a bunch of places. I'm the author of 5 novels from Small Press, Candlemark, and Gleam, the Extra Human series, and the Grey Line Sisters series. I'm also a short story writer. You can find my stuff in Strange Horizons, Apex, all that kind of good stuff.
Perfect. Thank you. And our next guest is Kate Elliott. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm Kate Elliott. I've been writing for quite a long time. I have write both science fiction and fantasy. I've published such series as Crown of Stars, Spirit Walker, Crossroads, and more to come. I have written twice as many novels as short stories and had my short stories recently collected by Tachyon Publications under the very best of Kate Elliott, which is true because it is all my short stories. So therefore, it is the very best of my short stories. I think that covers it.
Excellent, excellent. Next guest is Nalo Hopkinson.
Hi, I'm Nalo Hopkinson. I have published novels and short stories, and I'm starting to lose track of both, which might be a factor of how prolific I am or just a factor of what's happening to my memory. I am Canadian by way of the Caribbean and currently living in Riverside, California.
Teaching, as it happens.
I am teaching creative writing and science fiction and fantasy.
Excellent. That sounds awesome. And our last guest is Keffi Curley. Welcome to the show, Keffi.
Hello. I'm Keffi Curley. I write short fiction mostly. I've had short stories in places like Lightspeed and Escape Pod.
Is that it?
I don't know. I don't have nearly as...
No, I didn't mean it like that's all you published. I meant like you could mention a project.
I do also edit. I edited for Shimmer magazine for 5 years, and I'm currently in the process of launching a fiction podcast named Glittership, which will feature queer or LGBTQ or quilt bag, depending on how you like to say it, science fiction and fantasy short stories.
Perfect, perfect. So the topic for this particular discussion is somewhat broad. It's about writing, but it's about writing people beyond the margins is kind of the way in which I originally pitched it, with some help from Kate, who kind of helped me kind of push it a little further than where it had started. And so kind of where I wanted to start with the podcast is actually going with some of your own experiences as writers who've written various kinds of things about writing characters that are not like yourself. Which can be, it's a fairly broad question, but it's a good, I think it's a good place to start. And I guess I'll start with you, Susan, and just kind of go across the board again to kind of your experiences with writing people beyond, you know, what you normally identify with, or in some cases, maybe with what you identify with, and the kind of trials and tribulations.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly, I feel like I've written a lot of characters who are a little bit closer to me in a lot of ways. I tend to write women. I tend to write queer characters. The times when I write characters who are different from me in some sort of fundamental way, I always want to make sure that I'm doing a good job of it, and I'm actually, you know, not screwing it up too badly. I want to make sure I've done my research. I want to make sure I talk to people. I want to make sure that, like, I'm actually doing what I should be doing. But I think that, you know, as authors, we're always writing characters who are really, really different in a lot of ways. I mean, sure, I could write somebody, who might identify in a different way from me, but I'm also writing about people who have flight powers and can shoot fireballs and stuff like that. So it's, I don't know. I feel like there's always something different that I'm trying to get at.
Fair enough. Kate, did you want to add here?
My go-to is that with any character I write, the first thing I do is I recognize and I see their humanity. That's the first thing I want to see. Because if I can't see their humanity, I'm already stepping myself into a place where I'm removing them one step from me, whether or not their experiences are like mine. So I have to see them as fundamentally like me at the basic level in order to do a good job writing them as a character, as a person who people will be able to see as a person. Because if I see them as something else first, then I'm not going to be able to do it. And I wanted to quickly mention that anthropologically, people talk about, and this is probably kind of a Marxist way of looking at it, but people talk about earliest divisions of labor among, you know, early hominids. And really the first thing we divide on is age. Children aren't expected to do the same tasks as adults. And it seems like, although I don't know, that the second thing we tend to divide on is gender. And then we begin to get more and more of these splits as we kind of divide people out and talk about them being different or the same as us. But again, if you pull it all the way back to that, for that fixed point is that, first of all, we're human.
Excellent. I think there's some other questions that are going to bounce off a lot of what you said there. So we will probably come back in a minute. Nalo, did you have a perspective from your own writing that you wanted to add here?
Talking about writing characters who are unlike me?
Yeah.
Okay, and for me, that would often be straight white guys. And completely agree with Kate that you have to see your characters first as human. I think the tendency people have with writing an experience they don't have is to see that person as an ism. So instead of writing somebody who might be of color, you think, oh my God, I have to be writing about racism. Well, yes and no. Depends on who your character is. So first know them, figure out how they are like everyone else, and then figure out what is specific to their particular lives. And I find for me, then once I kind of fall in love with the character, that kind of stuff starts to fall into place. So I'm not trying to pull too hard to one side or the other to make it all about the thing I see that makes them not like me, or all about the thing I see that makes them so generic you can't tell them from anybody else.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, so again, more stuff we're going to come back to, I think. So, Kefi, would you jump in here, and then we can kind of hash out some of the individual things?
I think pretty much everything's already been said that as far as things that are really important, like seeing someone's humanity and making sure that you're not writing isms. I admit that I'm also kind of, especially if you're talking about writing different genders, I'm sort of falling into the same box as Nalo, where part of the difficulty for me was learning how to write people more like myself in terms of gender rather than writing the other, because I started out writing a lot of straight white guys, as I think a lot of people do when they start writing out, regardless of their background, due to what is most widely spread in science fiction and fantasy and literature in general. So, I'm sorry if I'm kind of dodging your question.
No, it's fine. Nalo, you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, because I didn't start out writing straight white guys so much. And I think everyone's got a different experience they're going to bring to the writing. I think I had the fortune of coming to self as a reading person in the Caribbean, where people of color are in the majority. And so it never really occurred to me, even though I was writing science fiction and fantasy from the beginning, to start writing the people who were on most of the pages most of the time. I think I started out thinking I need to put people like me on the page, but that's because I had the fortune to come from a Caribbean literary background where some of that work had been being done. I was watching it being done as I was growing up.
Okay, so there is kind of, depending on your personal experience of where perhaps you grew up, the kinds of characters or people that would have been considered maybe more standard differentiates based on those. I mean, I know Tobias Bacall has a very similar experience. He's, he's kind of had a reverse experience in which he's been writing novels intentionally kind of in a way of reconnecting with his childhood now that he lives in Ohio and not the Caribbean. So it's a very interesting reversal. Kefi, I see you had a hand. So before I jump to the next question, you want to kind of respond here?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to be really quick and say this is what's awesome about this conversation is that Nalo is able to show why my generic American view of what's going on is not accurate. Thank you, Nalo.
You're welcome.
In kind of going through these first kinds of responses, is some things that jump out, are some of which were things that I had intended to kind of touch on already. Susan had brought up the notion of research and hadn't quite unpacked that yet, and I did want to go to that because when it comes to writing characters that are either not like us or in some cases even people who are like us, there's, I hope, at least some degree of research involved in kind of making sure that works. And it certainly seems that with Kate and Nalo and Kefi kind of in adding to that, that the way in which you research it also kind of matters here, that this notion of looking for the humanity in the characters, kind of trying to find that. And so I wanted to go to first kind of getting to the research question and some strategies that you guys use in terms of your writing in kind of trying to create fully fleshed out people who may or may not be like yourself, some of the best strategies that you find for working out these kinds of characters. And I'm just going to go the opposite direction so Kefi gets to start. So Kefi, I'll start with you.
So I think I kind of work from in sort of a pyramid way where at first I'll read just very general stuff, like what I can find on the internet, sort of the low hanging fruit of books. And then as I find more and more things that make sense, to me and more things that are interesting, especially from a story point of view, then I kind of narrow down until I get to the point where I can think of actual questions to ask people if I, need to interview someone or ask someone questions about their experiences or their perspective on experiences. I will say that when I do talk to people, I try to take the point of view of, I'm looking for someone's perspective as a person of color or as a woman or whatever, rather than sort of the stamp of approval. And I think that's really important because no one can say, oh, this is definitely not problematic in any way, shape, or form. They can only speak to it from their experience and provide context as to what decisions you've made as a writer in your fiction. So, I think that's one thing I think is very important.
Yeah, you actually raised a really interesting point, which is, this isn't exactly the language you'd use, but the idea of who actually owns the narrative of a group, whatever that group may happen to be. And as you noted, right, when you speak to an individual kind of trying to just interact and learn, you have to be careful, as you know, that to not to assume that that person necessarily speaks for the whole. And I wonder, does everyone else kind of have this similar experience of the kind of the problem that sometimes people assume that, you know, one voice kind of represents the whole thing rather than a kind of individual voice within a larger group?
If I might.
Go for it.
Well, I think the thing that you need to do then is to ask more than one person because then sort of triangulate, because each group does own their experiences. Everybody owns the right to tell a story, and everybody's going to have a different experience of their experience. So I try to ask two or three people and then try and triangulate and then make sure that I'm still telling the story I want to tell. One of the things that's probably difficult for me in terms of writing characters who are not like me is writing working class characters. I think being black in North America, my race gets conflated with class, and I think I'm sometimes sort of assumed to speak for working class folks. Born and raised middle class. The other group that is completely alien to me is rich people. They're a complete mystery. I have no idea what they do, why, or how. And that one I'm still working on. But I think the thing to do is to, if you have people who are willing to read your work, people you're not imposing on, to ask more than one of them. And to the internet's a wonderful place for doing this kind of research. Sometimes I'll just go hang out in a community bulletin board for a while, one that's open, not to take part, but just to read people speaking in their own voices of their own experiences. And I've found that very, very valuable.
Well, what about you, Kate or Susan? Did you want to add to this?
I want to agree or co-sign with what Nalo and Kefi have said about doing research, but I wanted to actually kind of step back and go a little deeper into starting with me, because the first thing I do when I'm going to do research about an experience that isn't one that I've had is I question what I think I know, and why do I think I know it? Because what I find more than anything that gets in my way is unexamined assumptions, a kind of cultural baggage that we kind of like, well, we know that about these people, or this is what I've learned all my life. And if I was really clever, I could come up with a great example, which I will come up with in about an hour when it's too late. But, you know, we learn a lot of things about historical periods or about that you then discover either aren't true or are stereotypes that we have imposed that some of us have imposed on others, or that some of us have absorbed as we've grown up. And so that's the first place I have to go, is to look at myself and decide what I think about this subject or this identity that is my own obstacle. Once I've done that, then I will, and I never succeed fully in getting out from behind these things, but I do my best. And then I would go into, once I tried to tackle that, then I would try to go into the things about research that Nalo and Kefi have talked about. That's my, that's what I have to say.
Fair. One thing you were saying about the cultural assumptions, and I wonder, immediately made me think of an example, which, did anyone see the Reza Aslan, not quite interview, but he was on CNN, a few months ago after Bill Maher said some somewhat stupid things about Muslims. Does anyone see this?
Reza is in my department.
Oh, is he really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, so if you've not seen it, the very, very short version of it is, Bill Maher said some very kind of, the kind of thing we expect from U.S. rhetoric about Muslims, which is like, all Muslims are bad people because they're Muslim and it's evil. Like, you can go watch it on your own, but I don't recommend it. And so Reza was on CNN and he kept trying to explain over and over, like, you keep saying Muslims as though the Muslim world is like a monolithic thing. When, you know, you look at the individual countries, which are Muslim dominant countries, they're all very different. So like you're talking about problems in Saudi Arabia as though it applies to Indonesia. And he gets increasingly frustrated because they keep doing the same thing after he's pointed out to them why that's actually wrong. And it made me immediately think of what you were saying about the way in which cultural assumptions kind of infect the way we think about other people. And of course, the media being a primary way in which that sort of thing sort of is pressed upon a populace, because that the second something like CNN is doing this, it becomes a problem. And I'm guessing, Susan, you definitely want to jump in here.
Right. Yeah. And one thing I find, and I do a lot of research, not just for my characters, but I'm also a political columnist. So I'm always looking into political issues and social issues. And what I find during my research, whenever I do research on a group of people, culture, an issue, anything like that, is that I find it becomes more and more complex the further that I look into it. We have a tendency, I think, as humans to try and simplify things, and that's part of where stereotypes come from. But really, everything is incredibly complex. What that means for us when we do our research, it means that we can't find out everything, and we can't create characters who are supposed to be perfect representations of one thing or another. All we can do is try and get at that complexity in a way that is as true as we can make it for whatever group we're writing about.
Nala, you wanted to jump in before. Did you want to add to this?
Yes, and I really love what you guys are saying. And that whole thing that Kate was saying about checking your own biases first. I mean, what we're doing in writing science fiction and fantasy in large part is about questioning everybody's biases, making the reader call theirs into question. And so we have to start with ourselves. We have to start by trying to figure out what do we assume is true about a particular group, because everybody knows that. And I think that's part of the fun of it. I remember reading, oh, I wish I could remember the gentleman's name, a novel by a Muslim writer, a piece of fiction set in a Muslim country that was Orthodox Muslim. And the male characters in it, in the evenings, would go down the pub and have a drink. And it was a perfectly normal thing. It wasn't something anybody spoke about. People just knew where, you know, the place was where you would go have a drink. And it immediately called a whole lot into question for me, even though my father was Muslim from the Caribbean. So I would recommend reading the literatures of that group of people, reading their newspapers, just getting involved in the culture or subculture community by finding out what they're saying about themselves. And another way I've found those biases or you're thinking your experience is not, doesn't have anything to do with them, you can write from that. I got into, me and Pam Knowles got into a discussion with a white male writer a couple of years ago who was saying the reason he never writes black people is because he knows nothing about racism. And then he proceeded to tell stories about what it was like for him growing up, meeting the only black girl in his school and having a crush on her, and then having her leave the school, perhaps because it was just a really hard thing for her to do, or running around with his friends and using, you know, racial epithets and having his parents correct him. And I said, well, those are experiences of racism. So you do, and that's one thing. And the other is, we're more than just experiences of racism. There's more to black folks than, you know. So if you keep just focusing on the racism, and if you keep tricking yourself by saying that you have no experience of it. You're missing a whole opportunity to look at the connection you do have to race and racism from the point of view of somebody white. That's where I'm going with that.
It's very good. And I think Kate also wanted to kind of jump on this topic too.
Yeah, I was going to say something else, but now I want to say something else. No, and this whole thing, you know, that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, to follow up what Nala was saying, is we still see this, you know, when male writers say, I don't understand women, I can't write women because they're a mystery to me. But whenever anyone says that, whether, yeah, so you, sorry, someone's texting me there. Whenever anyone says that, what, regardless if it's about gender or ethnicity or religion, what's happening is they're subscribing to essentialism. And again, to come back to what, I don't remember who said this, but this idea that one person's experience stands in for all people's experience in this group over there. But we over here, where I stand, we're all individuals. But as long as you see black experience or women's experience or whatever it may be as an essentialist thing, almost a molecular thing that can't be separated again from their ascent, from their humanity, it's going to be very hard to write them. As a person, in the same way you would if you were writing someone who was just had exactly the same experience as you, you wouldn't think twice about making them an individual. So that's where, again, I would have people question, kind of dig down into their own assumptions.
A kind of problem of stereotyping a group, whatever that group may be, of kind of assuming they're all kind of the same.
Well, I mean, essentialism is a serious problem. If you believe that men and women are at some molecular level so totally different, then you will have trouble writing the opposite gender or a gender that is not binary if you believe that that's how things are. Mm. You know, so you have to get past that. You have to get past that yourself. Or you have to say, that's what I believe, so I'm just not going to try, which is, you know, it's not what I would care to do. But for some people, I think that may be the best thing for them to do, if you see what I mean. You know,
okay.
If they're simply so uncomfortable going anywhere else, then write what they want to write. I'm assuming that those people are not listening to this podcast. I'm assuming the people who are listening to this podcast are people who are trying to open up their world and make it bigger.
I certainly hope so. So we'll go to Susan, and then I do want to bring in Keffi, because Keffi's been a little silent. So Susan, and then to Keffi, and then we'll go to Nalo.
Sure. One of the things, I'm trans, and one of the things that I learned, you know, living in various genders is, and this is one of the things that I think surprised me even a little bit, is that how similar it all is, that there's not some great divide that you necessarily cross. It's not a completely 100% different world, that there's so many similarities, but people simply don't see them. Or people don't want to see them, that there's such belief, as Kate was saying, is about essentialism, about the idea that everyone is so completely and unknowably different, that we're alien to each other, but that's just not the case. And, you know, when people start to actually think about it, there's so much more that connects us. And that's a great place to start writing from, is figuring out where those connections are.
Keffi?
actually, I think I'm going to jump backward a little bit. I thought about putting up a hand and then was like, oh, we're kind of moving on. This is actually back, I can't remember who said it now, but about reading the literature of particular groups, to learn more about them. And I want to say that is extremely key, is reading stories or books by people in those particular groups. And it actually reminded me of something that I want to mention, which was, Hiromi Goto's, and I hope I didn't just butcher her name, Hiromi Goto's WISCON, guest of honor speech. It's on her website. But I I mean, you should put this in the show notes because I think that especially every white writer who wants to write about other races and ethnicities should read it, because she has a set of what I think can be very difficult questions that she wants, that she suggests authors ask themselves before writing about marginalized groups. And it contains things like asking if that group has had the chance before you to tell their story in the language that you're going to be writing in. And it's something that should have occurred to me before I heard her say that at WISCON, but hadn't actually occurred to me to look into that specifically. And so I think there's also, it's also important to pay attention to when you might be drowning out the voices of people from that particular group based on how you're coming to writing about it. But now I'm really worried that I've just shot us off into a completely different orthogonal direction. So
I'll quickly jump in here really fast about scholarship. When I do research, I just really want to agree again that it's all very well to find, because I only read in English. I know a few other languages not well, but I only read in English. And so I often deal with scholarship because I'm often researching historical cultures, and I deal with scholarship often written in English or translated into English by academics who almost without exception are outsiders studying another culture. If I'm not doing, like American history so what I always seek out is translations. And they're available through academic presses but translations from people, from different cultures, and because that's where I'm going to get how people talk about and think about themselves as opposed to what I think about them.
And even with a translation, there's always that flaw because, of course, it's in many cases they try to put it in trying to take phrases and common sayings in another language and translating it into English, which sometimes doesn't work.
You know, as Susan said, we're dealing with such levels of complexity that there's a point at which you say, I'm going to do my best.
Yeah.
and if I can only read in English, then I'm going to do my best within that within my own limitation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nala, you had a hand a while back, but I suspect you may want to tackle some of the topics that have kind of resurfaced here.
Mm-hmm, yes. And I particularly liked Kefi talking via Hiromi, and yes, you did get that right, Kevi, talking about beware of deciding that you've just become the voice of a group of people who haven't had the chance to tell their own stories. Doesn't mean you don't tell that story, but too often I see people presenting themselves as the authority when I can't find the voices from that particular group out there at all. So I think a certain humility is helpful to everybody. And I wanted to go back to the idea of writing the other from writing your own experience, because I now have two examples. And one is Ellen Klages's award-winning story, Basement Magic, which she originally wrote for an anthology for me, and I ended up not being able to take. I had too many stories, and with tears and just wailing, I let that one go. And it went on to win a Hugo, which I thought was wonderful. What Ellen did with that is to write about a little white girl whose family has maid. So she writes the experience of the black maid through the eyes of the little white girl. And that was an easier thing, I think, for Ellen to write than to try to turn it around. And it ended up being a beautiful story because it talks about that little girl's perception of this woman who's looking after her, but whose life is way more complex than the little girl can understand. And then I had the experience a few years before that of Sorry, I'm hearing noises in the background.
I apologize. My husband just came home and the dog is kind of running around in excitement. I'm going to move my...
If you want, you can just use the little mute button and that'll... that's kind of resolved.
Where the heck is my little mute button?
It sounded exactly like claws on tile.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
So I was writing a short story where I wanted to write a sex scene between a trans man and a queer woman, and clutched for literally a year because at the time, one, I was still straight identified, and two, I was writing from the perspective of the trans man, and eventually realized, wait a minute, I might not know what his experience will be like, but I kind of sort of know what hers will. And so wrote his experience of her reactions. You see what I mean? You can take what you know and write it that way and get to the story that way. It is still a valid expression of the experience of that person you don't know that well. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I totally making sense. I'm just nodding in agreement. In silent agreement.
Which, of course, nodding on a podcast works perfectly.
Yeah, exactly.
It does make sense. And one of the things that I find really interesting is this does come up. It's come up kind of twice already. Is the question of appropriation. Right, this attempt that I think all of us are kind of talking about here of trying not to appropriate, trying to find ways to get at stories that maybe not within ourselves, but trying to find new avenues to get to them without exploiting or appropriating other people's narratives. And obviously that can be a problem when it comes to far more marginalized cultures. I think I've had a couple discussions with people in the last couple weeks about Aboriginal writers in Australia, and in particular this last week, because one of the texts that I've been teaching for this course actually refers to the this artistic project in Australia, and I've forgotten the name of the particular tribal group, and they've basically been selling their artwork as a way to kind of survive. But on the same token, are trying to create artworks as a way to demonstrate their connection with the land so they can petition the government to basically, like, create the land as kind of a preserve, or I'm not sure exactly what the proper title would be. And of course, this is always this kind of weird disconnect because they're creating this art, which is being sold internationally among art dealers, who may not fully have any comprehension of what is actually being put into the artwork. And so they're interpreting it within a very different lens. And what's kind of being lost is the translation that would exist between them. I don't know if that's making any sense, what I'm trying to get at. But it does seem to be a concern of trying to sort of write about other people, whoever they may be, without sort of doing it in a way that exploits them or misrepresents them in a way. And Kefe, I think you're typing hand, so I'll just beat you to it. Get to it. Go for it.
Well, I just wanted to say that I think that, I mean, it depends on who you talk to. I think it's very hard to write something from especially the perspective of a group that is more, someone in a group that is more marginalized than yourself on whichever axis, without appropriating a little bit in some way. And then you get into the question of what is and isn't appropriate. And I think this is where I was coming from a long time ago when I mentioned that, individuals can only give you their perspective on the situation, like whether or not what you've done is appropriative or if it's acceptable. And I think that one of the things that I've noticed is that there have been times when I've decided not to write a particular story because I didn't think that I was personally capable at that point in time of writing that story without being appropriative, basically going what I would perceive as too far in being appropriative of someone else's story. And this has had to do with, oh, I'm sorry, I can't remember exact details, but because it was a while ago, but it had to do with not wanting to write about something that I didn't think I was quite capable of understanding properly, especially when it was the perspective of a group that I didn't see a lot of fiction from. And what's funny is I made that decision before I'd even heard Hiromi talk. But I do think it's okay to make the decision to put things aside for a little bit. And I know that although there are a lot of groups that I may write stories that have characters from those particular groups, personally, it would be a very long time before I would feel comfortable writing from an Australian Aboriginal point of view. And for me, there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that I don't understand the politics, and the amount of time that I would have to take to get to that point, it's just going to take a long time before I would ever be at that point. But also because of the different levels of marginalization that come into play, especially when it comes to stories about Australian Aboriginal people. So yeah, I think I'm just flailing around wildly now, and someone else should probably talk.
Kate, so you want to jump in there?
Yeah, this is not directly related to direct questions of appropriation, but this is a conversation I've had with Cindy Pon, a young adult writer. You know, the reality is, and I've said this before, the reality is that as a white writer, I can write about anything. And I'm not saying that I should. I'm saying that I can. And I'm not saying that I can do it successfully, but I'm saying that the market will give me a lot more leeway. People, so if I want to write a story set with a kind of an Asian feel to it, it's like, oh, look at her. She's being diverse. Whereas if Cindy does it, Cindy is like, well, of course she's writing Asian inspired fiction. She's Asian, right? So automatically she's getting pigeonholed, whereas I'm getting this kind of bigger platter offered to me. Do you see what I'm saying? So, you know, right away there, that's an issue. Now, does that stop me? I've always written, and I don't know this word diversity. I use it because it's the word we have, but I've always written diversely, but I'm also aware that it's been more possible for me to do it with, I think I have taken some, I think it's been a disadvantage in some ways. To do that, but I think it's easier for me to do it because I'm kind of protected by being white. Does that make sense?
I think what I'm saying?
You know, yeah. So it's an advantage for me, and I need to recognize that when I write.
So just to make sure I fully understand, just to give an analogy of a kind of racial stereotype, but like assumptions about, you know, you meet somebody who's of Asian descent and people will ask them like, oh, well, where are you from? And they'll say things like, well, I'm from like Los Angeles or wherever. And people want to know like, well, no, they're from what part of Asia were they originally from? And that kind of assumption that by being of Asian descent, they must therefore have some sort of deep connection to wherever their, you know, eighth grandpa was from or what have you. Is that kind of what you're getting at, that kind of assumption there?
I'm thinking Nalo has something to say about this. But
okay.
to use Cindy really quickly, if she writes a story with an Asian setting, then it's like, well, of course she's doing it for that reason. But if I do it, it's like, Nalo, can you just answer this?
Yeah, Nalo, jump in here. Yeah.
I'll try. it's the problem of visibility. People assume I'm writing black characters. They assume any creature that I create has to be from Caribbean folklore. And you know, sometimes I want to write white characters and I want to write about elves. So, but yes, there's a way in which, Kate is sort of assumed to have this large palette that other people apparently aren't supposed to, because we're only supposed to be interested in, I don't know, something that is 100% like because whatever the hell that may be. Niecy Shaul and Cindy Ward talk about the concept of appropriate appropriation. I think, because the thing is, when you read a story or a book written from a perspective that is not the author's, and there are times it feels right. It feels satisfying. You get done reading it if you are from that community and you think, yes, I feel represented. I feel seen. She gets my jokes. She knows what it's like to try and, you know, fit through the turnstile, hit a TDC subway. And so it's a hard thing to understand or to describe or even, you know, for me to delineate, but in a way that feels to me like appropriate appropriation. If you write the story and you have loved your characters, so you are interested in them, that comes across. On the other hand, I find when we try to talk about this notion of appropriation, the first thing that comes in to counter it is usually white, usually male voices, writers yelling, "No one can censor me." Nobody's talking about censorship. They're talking about thinking about what you do, thinking about the consequences of what you do. And as you've all been saying, it's perfectly fine to decide this is not your story to write, or this is a story that could be cool, but you're actually really not that interested in that particular group, so you know you're not going to get it right. Those are valid choices. But really, you got to think about what you do. Don't just sort of blunder in and assume that you can walk away with all the china and tell people that you invented china.
Yeah,
that's it.
I like that last analogy. yeah, I think that clarifies a lot of that. Yeah.
Thank you, Nalo. I knew you could do that.
Before we switch. I wanted to switch to one last little piece towards the end, but I wanted to see if Susan or Keffi had any last thoughts in this particular training. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah. I feel like it's a question, and a lot of the sort of really bad cases of appropriation that I've seen often come from a place where somebody is not being respectful of the people and the culture and the group that they're writing about. And it's not to say that they're thinking really badly of them, but they're not taking the time to really understand, to approach that particular group from a position of humility and respect and being open. And that's when you see a lot of stuff that's very, you know, makes people very uncomfortable. And I figure that you can write about other groups as long as you do it in a way that is respectful and you come at it from a place of trying to understand as much as you possibly can. And that goes back again to the questions of doing your research and being open and and reading the literature. And if you've done all of those things, then you have a better shot at doing it right.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so two people with hands up.
Can I say something really quick?
Go for it.
I agree with what Keffi has said, and it brings me back to something Nalo said. When I read, let's say, a book with women characters in it who feels very stereotyped and very flat to me, I get the impression the writer doesn't love them, which is what Nalo said. So I think this idea of loving your characters is a way of seeing them as a whole person as opposed to someone that they have to, you know, someone who that's at some point, at some place in their psyche, they don't like or distrust those characters. I feel like I can read that. And I'm not talking about character personality. I'm talking about a deeper level of stereotype, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I mean, obviously we write villains who we're not supposed to love as characters, but we may still love them as creations, if you see what I mean. Anyway.
Well, and sometimes people write villains that we actually, for reasons we shouldn't, sometimes love them. which I had a conversation on Twitter about that very thing with Abigail Nussbaum about unlikable characters sort of being written in a way that made us like them. So like murderers who are treated as sort of charming and the kind of weird, and I see that as like a weird literary trick that we're sort of tricked into loving someone that for all intents and purposes we shouldn't like. I think that's really fun, just to kind of realize what you're being kind of manipulated. Nalo, get you to jump in, and then Keffi, any final thoughts from you, and then we will have to switch topics really quick.
Okay, I wanted to add to what Susan's saying, that the notion that you need to come at learning about the people you're writing about with respect and humility, and I think part of respect is realizing that doesn't mean you make them angels all the time, but it does mean you don't tokenize them. So if you, I mean, people think that what we're saying, all of us, when we say this stuff, is that you can't have evil characters from whatever particular group it is. That's not so. But still, yes, you do have to love them and love them as characters, and it helps to not tokenize them. Don't have the you know, the horrible simpering villain be the only representative of that group in your story. Have 10 or 12 more. Flesh out a little, you know, a little bit more of all the things you've learned about that group of people.
Excellent. And Keffi, last thoughts on this particular train?
Actually, this is just building off of what Susan and Nalo said. For me, I'm also trans. I'm trans male. And so I frequently get asked to read stories in which characters are trans. And one of the things that I'm doing, besides just knowing that I can only provide context on my own background, even so, I'm not like sitting down with a checkbox of like, is this how I experienced my transness when I was 12? Check. Is this how it happened when I was 13? Check. Because there are ways in which people in every group experience things differently. But what I am looking for is whether or not it feels like the experience of the character is based on a whole human being that the author has spent time understanding and getting to know, and that they understand what it might feel like to be that particular character in that situation. And then similarly, Nalo mentioned, you know, don't have the villain be the only one from that background. And I will just say, and I'm pretty sure this is true of basically every group, but we tend to move in packs. Okay, you know how when you're reading a story and there's like the one gay character, and he is the only gay character, and all of his friends are women, and I'm sure there have been maybe some gay men who only had friends who were women, but most likely they know other people who are gay in some way. So anytime I read a story in which there's literally only one person in that entire universe who is of any particular minority group, it just feels false to me now, because even if the character... you know what? I'm just going to use Basement Magic, which Nalo mentioned, because I just reread that recently. In that story, even though the protagonist, who is a young white girl, doesn't know her black maid's family, there's still reference to the fact that she has a family in the story, which I think helps.
Yes.
Because even if they don't show up, they will exist. So even if you're writing a story in which there are only two characters, quote unquote, on screen, it's useful to have in your mind and even drop mention that there are other characters in that group. So even if you only have room to put one character because you're writing really close, there's only two characters yelling at each other or whatever, they should still just acknowledge that they will have other friends who are in their group that they go home to talk to afterward or whatever. So yeah, that's what I wanted to add on that.
Okay. So some of this is leading to what was the sort of opposite end of the spectrum that I kind of wanted to address, because we started talking about writing people beyond ourselves. And so I wanted to kind of switch for a little bit to talk about some of the things that have come up already, which is some of the bad practices or in some cases just generally bad things that sometimes people do when they write people that are like you guys, in whatever sense that means. So it could be like, you know, people who write about geeks or Firefly fans or whatever. So I hope that maybe we'd have some perspectives on that, given that we have a pretty different sort of group, and I like that. So would anyone want to start in sort of talking about the kinds of ways in which people maybe get things wrong?
Oh, so much to say.
Do you want to start and then we'll go to Kate? Or do you want to take a minute to collect your thoughts?
I'll probably forget them if I take a minute to collect them. I lose things, including my thoughts. So assume that people like the group you're writing about have all the variances you'd find in any human population. So I just finished a story that's set in a shanty town in a country very much like Jamaica. But I reminded myself that everybody in Jamaica has a cell phone. And so my character can, while she's creating the lovely scientific doohickey she's creating, she's a little girl. She can Google any information she needs on her grandma's cell phone. I like to, again, question my own biases by some of the scientific questions this little girl has, her grandmother answers. And these are people who live in a shantytown who, you know, with everything that comes along with that, you're supposed to assume that they are uneducated or not paying attention or have too much else in their minds and that they can't innovate. So I like mixing up adjectives. So if you can think, you know, put a different adjective with the noun that you've got and see what you can make of that character. I recently had somebody sort of tap me on the shoulder and say, you know, we should be friends because I have a lot of friends, but I don't have any sassy black ones. Wow. Sassy black female friends. Yeah, that conversation didn't last.
Who says that to anybody?
Right? So suppose he'd put a different adjective in front of black female, you know, suppose he'd put Hulk fan. I don't know anything. He would have had a different sense of perhaps of what black women are. So yeah. Mix up your adjectives, put them with different nouns, see what you get.
Okay. That's wow. Okay. a phrase I don't think I would have ever heard uttered.
You and me both.
Yeah. This semester's been weird because I've had at least three students use the word retarded in its non-correct form, which has been like a thing I've had to correct a number of times. So I'm like, yeah, we should not refer to that term in that way. It's been fun. Yeah, it's they're 18 and I don't think they've quite understood words yet. That's a terrible way of phrasing that. But in any case, enough about that. Kate, you wanted to take a stab at this too.
Well, to come back to this idea of quotas, I love it when people say, oh, you just want us to fill in quotas. As soon as someone uses that word, I realize that in their life, the presence of whoever it is that they feel is a quota is actually not something that is really very present in their life. At least that is my assumption, because including a diverse range of characters in fiction is really not that big a deal. If you live in a world where it's where you see the world as diverse. With women in particular, and to come back to this idea of only seeing one, like, you know, you might be a story where there's the exceptional girl or the girl who goes along with the group of men or, you know, but she's the only one or she doesn't have. I just wrote a huge post on Tor.com a couple weeks ago called Writing Women Characters. And, you know, one of the first things I say is that write women who talk to each other. And I don't mean the Bechdel test by that, but the women who interact with each other, and then write a lot of women in background roles, in secondary roles, in tertiary roles, the woman you, you know, buy something from at the market. But don't populate 90% of your world with, you know, white men and then wonder why the people who aren't straight white men come across as stereotypes, because we are, you know, we are. Try to understand each individual personality within the context of the culture or cultures that that character moves within, because we're each going to move within the culture differently because we're each different, even if we only catch a glimpse of that. If the tertiary character, you know, maybe the woman in the market is cranky today. So she might just be cranky. That might be all you see about her, but that suggests that she has something that makes her a human being. So again, this idea of you have multiple people so you can see a range of personalities, just like people have in real life throughout all cultures, throughout all times.
Excellent, excellent. Susan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I see a lot, and I sort of grind my teeth whenever I see it, is the idea that you have to have a character in a story to teach a lesson to the other characters. And, you know, this often comes up with the narrative of somebody who has a terrible tragedy happen to them. Queer characters, for some reason, seem to have this happen a lot. The tragedy narrative. So that someone can learn an important lesson. It's like an after-school special kind of a thing. And that's, you know, a lot of the literature that was written by people who were not part, of the queer community in any way tended to go in that direction for a long time, where there'd be some sort of terrible tragedy. Somebody would die, you know, the gay man would die of AIDS. I can't think of any movies that have done that. I'm sure we can think of a few. That kind of thing where here's something heartbreaking that's going to happen to this character, so that the quote unquote normal characters, the characters that the readers or the writers can more easily identify with, learn an important lesson and then just walk away. And that's something that I think is so toxic at this point. That if you're going to write that kind of a story, you know, you really want to think about, why am I writing this story? What's the point of it? Is this really the story that I want to tell? Is there a better way to get across the message that I'm interested in getting across?
That's an excellent point, Susan.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a few of those. They are also not necessarily a reflection of reality.
No.
You know, not, it's not always people learn, you know, they just meet somebody and like, I have a tragic event and then somebody teaches me a lesson and that's it.
Yeah, I just live my life in total tragedy all the time. That's all I do. Sit around, stewing it. Yep.
It's just much more complicated than the kind of simplistic, trope. So, but on that note, Keffi, you need to jump in.
Sorry, I had my microphone muted. good job. I'm a scientist, everyone. I wanted to...
Hey, as Prometheus taught us, Keffi, scientists may know how to vaguely use tools, but they can't read maps.
Okay.
No?
I didn't watch that.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So I want to jump in on the after-school special. I'm going to call it the after-school special discussion that Susan brought up. I think that a lot of the places where that falls down is in assumptions that are made by the author. And this also goes back to, anyway, it'll get more complicated. but I don't think authors always ask who the author or who the audience is when they write. They just assume an audience. And I think in the case of a lot of the after school special stories, if you really look at them, it looks like the author is automatically assuming that the audience that should be or will be, or that they want to have read their story, necessarily doesn't include anyone from that particular group. So they're assuming that this is a story written for other straight people to learn that gay people shouldn't have bad things happen to them because otherwise you'll get really sad. And I think that it's important to think about who you're assuming will and will not read the story, and deciding whether or not, I think that's one of the things where it's interesting to think about, because it's possible that you have a lot of assumptions about who the audience for the story might be that you didn't think of looking at because you were so busy building the rest of the story. And I think building on that too, the issue with assumptions is that, like Kate said, when you get just one woman in the story, a lot of times that's because the author hasn't even realized that they're defaulting to male characters, and they haven't even asked why a particular character needs to be male. Like, why is the shopkeeper a guy? Does he need to be a guy? Does it matter if he's a guy? And questions like that. So I think underlying assumptions are a big issue there.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And those assumptions can also affect readers, which I think most of us noticed when they made the casting choices for The Hunger Games, and the Amanda Stenberg was cast as Rue, and everybody freaked out. Well, not everybody, but primarily white people freaked out because they were like, well, I didn't know she was black, because they assumed just by default that she would be a white person. Even though it's in the text that she is it says at like one line that she's dark skinned. Those kinds of assumptions are pervasive. Nala, do you want to jump in here?
Yeah. Sort of stuff that both Susan and Kathy have had to say. I think part of the reason you end up with the othered character being the one who teaches the protagonist lessons about life or sacrifices themselves for the protagonist, or is because it hasn't occurred to you to make them the protagonist. So one of the things we need to ask ourselves is what are our own biases around who makes a fitting protagonist for a story. I mean, one of the things I need to challenge myself on is making more disabled characters the protagonists of my stories. And it's something, you know, I'm thinking about more and more recently, and looking back at my own stories and thinking, there are places where you could have made a choice that was more interesting than the one you've made. And yet it does really affect people's lives. I am so sick and tired of seeing, for instance, trans characters who have sorry love lives. Sorry, but that's not what I'm seeing in my life around me. So people who are writers who assume that, you know, by transitioning, this character has gone beyond any possibility of having a sex life or a love life, or gay characters who don't. But if you find yourself doing that, ask yourself just what's going on for you, and is there a way you could be writing something more interesting and perhaps more true to life?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't type hand in.
It's okay.
Can I say something? So a couple of years ago, I wrote a post about the male gaze and the female gaze, called The Omniscient Breast, that was on SF Signal. But one of the things I talked about was how we see so much in film, and in books where we're seeing from the male gaze. And by that I mean, that the picture frame, whether of the textual narrative or of the visual narrative, is sees a woman from the gaze of a heterosexual man who is seeing maybe her, maybe the camera focuses on her butt in a, and, or possibly, I need to say possibly, it isn't just a heterosexual man that this gaze is from, but it's generally seen that way. Let me say that, because I know that there are more complicated gazes. But that often women will write this way as well without meaning to, because they've so absorbed this way of looking at the world. So their female characters may see themselves as if they are in the centerfold of a Playboy magazine. But I wrote this about this very issue and about how we needed to think about how we were looking, especially at our women characters. And of course, someone jumped in the comments and said, well, you know, the reason to come back to Nalo's point about protagonists, the reason that we don't write about women in fantasy is because women never did anything in the past. The 99% of women in medieval Europe were illiterate, pregnant peasant women who never went farther than 5 miles from their home. So says this guy, right? So two things happen when this happens, when this kind of comment comes up. One is that you realize that this person really doesn't know anything about history. And the other one is how comfortable that statement is to him. How it gives him comfort to say that. So, you know, we have to think about how much these narratives that these stereotypical narratives give comfort to the people who tell them and to read them, because they tell them a story. They kind of, it's not that they necessarily want to hear it, but it's one they've heard so much that they going outside that is makes them anxious. So it's important as a writer to think about what makes you comfortable and what makes you uncomfortable as you're writing, and to kind of push at that discomfort. I will say that I then went on to write a short story in which the main character was an illiterate pregnant peasant woman who does something really important based completely without having her do anything that would have been everything that she does in the story, I can find attested in evidence for the medieval period. So,
yeah, I find those narratives really scary in a way, because they're said and they're uttered without sort of questioning. I mean, like you'll say something like, you know, well, women didn't do anything in the Middle Ages, and nobody stops. Well, the people who say that, they don't stop and they think, well, why is that the narrative that we know? And that can't possibly be true, because there were millions and millions of women, right? The idea it's a myth. I mean, there were women doing all kinds of crazy stuff in the old days. I say the old days, like, you know, like any of us were capable of being alive back then. But I don't know. It just seems it's the unquestioning nature of it. Like, we just accept this narrative without interrogating why. Nalo?
Women who do stuff everybody knows sprang whole cloth without their bras from the 1970s.
Absolutely.
That sounds
it's
right.
It's all
yeah.
the fault of Title IX. That passing make.
I guess, Kefi, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I actually, this is something I think that, when I read particularly egregious examples of trans people in literature, I think a lot of this comes down to the narratives that people are comfortable with. Because a lot of the narratives around trans people, although we're starting to get some better ones, a lot of the ones that are in the media tend to be overwhelmingly negative and usually extremely simplistic. Like, Nalo mentioned people who write trans characters who don't have any love lives. And I think in a lot of cases, that's because the author themselves, even though they're not fundamentally opposed to the idea of a trans person being in a relationship, is unable to, for whatever reason, imagine themselves in a relationship with a trans person, or let alone imagine themselves as a trans person in a relationship. But I don't want to stretch them too far. And because of that, they have trouble writing those stories or writing anything outside of that, because that is forcing them to go outside of the narrative of things that are icky to them. And one of the things that I see in a lot of mainstream media, and then also sometimes gets reiterated in stories, is that there is, I would say, a lot of the cis person gaze with respect to trans people is very surgery oriented. So you get a lot of discussions of what kind of surgery has he had? What kind of surgery has she had? And even in, like, I will read stories that are ticking along just fine, and then they have to make sure that the audience knows exactly at what quote-unquote stage of transition the trans character is. And a lot of that is because the narratives that we're told about trans people tend to focus, even when they're not as negative, tend to focus a lot on the physical body, and how that is or isn't changed to realign with someone's actual gender. So, yeah, I think that's one place where I see things going wrong in fiction. And some of it has to do with the narratives that we already know, and some of it has to do with, in a lot of cases, if you're doing your research for trans characters based entirely on mainstream media without looking into things that we've written about ourselves, you're probably going to get a lot of really bad information. So.
Susan. Yeah.
I just wanted to add to that. I'm sorry. I just forgot what I was going to say. Oh dear. It'll come to me in a second. I think I was going to talk about what Kepi was saying just now. Oh, Lord, come back to me. I'm sorry. My cat was running around being sick.
Just another phrase I didn't think I would hear.
No, here we go.
Did you get it?
Oh, it's so close. No, I think I've got it now. I think what a lot of people, that's sort of the danger of these sort of narratives that are everywhere, is that, you could do research. And you can find out things, but you still might not get past all of these narratives and tropes that are, you know, these things that are just sort of dominant narratives that aren't necessarily true. So you can do research and find out things, but the things that you find out might be toxic in some way. They might be problematic in some way. And that's why it's so important to really talk to people. You can read, you can absorb things. But you still might end up with bad stuff. Because if you read a lot of literature about, let's say, trans people from, you know, the last decade or so, you get the kind of stuff that Kefi was talking about, very surgery-focused, sad people who have no sex lives, that kind of stuff. And you might think, because you're finding stuff, that that's what it says. Well, then maybe that's true. And that's where you go with it. So that's why it's important, so important, to really talk to people.
Excellent. So, Kefi, I'm going to make this the last comment because we're running a little over an hour. And I want to make sure everybody can mention their upcoming or most recent projects. And then we got to kind of close out. So, Kefi, you get the last word.
Oh my gosh.
Make it good.
Yeah, when I put that up. Oh, I was going to say, like, now I'm a little worried because it's probably a little bit of a can of worms. But I was just going to say, some of these mainstream narratives are things that, especially for myself, learning how to write about trans characters or characters who had similar experiences, even to my own, there was a lot of needing to expunge some of these toxic narratives from my own understanding of myself. So I guess that's just adding yet another layer of possibly concerning stuff to trying to find out what these narratives are and how to avoid them. So, yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. So, we got to kind of wrap up. So I'm going to go through and just have everybody just kind of talk about your most recent project or an upcoming one, as the case may be. And I'm just going to start with you first, Kate.
I'm going to say one more thing because you can't stop me, and it's going to be short. You know, I want to just say one thing. I'm always writing from the space I'm in now, and I'm always aware I am still and can still be learning. So that's how I keep myself going, because I make mistakes, but I can still learn, and I do still learn. My young adult debut, Court of Fives, is coming out in August. I call it, kind of Little Women. It's Little Women meets some of my, says Game of Thrones, although it just doesn't really work. But anyway, it's a story set in a fantasia of the Greco-Roman period of Egypt, but it's about four sisters, and one in particular. It's also about colonialism. It's a complicated book, that I really love. And then I have an epic fantasy coming out in November called Black Wolves. So that is, what's coming for me this year.
Excellent. Excellent. And then I'm going to jump to you, Susan.
All right. The thing I've got coming up next, I've got a story, and this is just, released a table of contents today. I've got a story in the Queers Destroy Science Fiction issue of Lightspeed. That story is called Die, Sophie, Die, and I'm so excited about being part of that collection. It's going to be awesome.
That's great. That's great. Congratulations. And Nalo, what about you?
I have a second short story collection coming out in the summer, July or August, I believe, called Falling in Love with Hominids. It's coming out from Tachyon. Most of the stories have been published singly in other places, and this is sort of an assemblage of them.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. And Kefi, you are the last. You are working on something, are you not?
Yes, I do have one of my own short stories coming out sometime soon. It's going to be an Uncanny magazine. It's called And Never Mind the Watching Ones. And this one, I actually use some of the stuff we were talking about, because most of my protagonists in this are teenagers. And so I spent a lot of time on Tumblr, which is a great place to go if you want to see how teenagers talk to each other, because there are a lot of teenagers on Tumblr. Much more than I would say on Twitter, or definitely not Facebook. And then I'm also in the process of launching Glittership, which is the podcast I mentioned earlier. Our first episode will come out on April 2nd, and that's the editorial since I'm the only person running it. And I'm currently in the middle of kickstarting that, which will end on April 8th.
April 8th. Perfect. So if you want to support that, by the time this comes out, there'll be, I think, 5 days left. So, well, perfect. So, thank you all very, very much for, agreeing to come on and talk with me, about these very interesting topics. So thank you, Susan, for taking time out.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you so much, Sean. Absolutely.
Thank you, Nalo.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kefi.
Thank you.
Perfect. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.